Cold in Court with Mike Trevelyan and Dean Sheridan.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Holding Court. This is the podcast where we discuss crimes, laws, things of that nature, and I discuss it, me, Dean Sheridan, one of your hosts, with your other host, Michael Trevelyan, the learned barrister. I like the word learned. I use it a lot on the show. You will see in time if this is your first episode. If it's not, you're like he's saying learned again. How are you, Mike?
I'm well, thank you. I must admit, I also like the word learned, and I use it quite a lot in court because, of course, barristers refer to each other as their learned friends, and I always refer to the judge as the learned judge. So it is a word I get to use quite a lot, which I find quite enjoyable.
Whereas I can't be referred to as learned because I have not learned enough to be learned.
Indeed. And interestingly, I might have said this before, actually, but if you're a member of parliament and you were a barrister, then you're entitled to be referred to as the honourable and learned gentleman. Mm. I'm well. It's a beautiful, sunny afternoon. The sun is absolutely roasting. So that is ideal. I had a slightly odd situation yesterday. For the last couple of days, Percy, my puppy, has had a slightly unwell eye. It's been a bit kind of watery and red. And then yesterday I noticed a little bit of grass poking out from under the eyelid. So after quite a long time, he was willing to let me get the tweezers and pull out this little bit of grass. And as I pulled it out, it turned out to be a massive piece of grass that had been stuck under his eye for days. Oh. So now he's feeling much happier, which is nice. So likewise, I am feeling much happier. How are you, Dean?
I'm very, very good. Yes. Just come off of a performance last night, which was Saturday night. I do some singing stuff occasionally. Me and my friend get drunk and warble into microphones. And yes, it went down very well. Anyone who listens and wants to hear us warble, look up Gildino on Facebook.
That's Gildeano.
But yes, it was a very enjoyable evening and very, very, very positive. And the weather was lovely, but I was stuck inside all day in that room, the performance room. I didn't really get to enjoy it. So hopefully I get to enjoy it a bit more today.
Yes. Do you not have like a green room for the celebrities to go and hang out in at events like this?
No, not with that, because we were part of a dancing show. Basically, the dance school gets all the fancy dressing rooms. And we just have to sit in the corner until summoned.
I see. That's not quite as rock and roll as I was hoping for.
No, we also spent most of the day in the tech room, like hanging with the tech, and it's like a small room. So actually, it was not only was it a warm day, but it was extra warm in the small room that we all decided to hang out in.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how uncomfortable was that?
I didn't mind it too much, but it was definitely sweaty. When I got home, I had to peel the trousers off. There's a beautiful image for you, ladies and gents.
I told you before about wearing those leather trousers.
Yes, I know. Well, I'm still going to finally hit my dream of being Michelle Pfeiffer from Batman Returns. So.
Not just your dream. Your dream, Dean. I'm sure other people have also had that dream to see you as Michelle Pfeiffer.
So keep an eye out. The next local Comic-Cons, you might see me going around in the original Catwoman outfit.
Well, I look forward to it.
So I will start with our first case of today. And this is a strange one, because this goes to a little bit when we talked about omission in the UK. But then again, I don't think this counts as omission, because in certain jobs, I guess you have a duty of care that can actually almost put the omission not being an option for you. You know, like being a doctor and omitting not to operate on someone that's bleeding to death or something like that might be a bit different than if you're a guy who walks down the road and decide not to intervene in a situation. But this is in America as well. So I know the omission thing is a UK-based thing, but also this is more like they're looking along the lines of negligence. So this is a 911 dispatcher who was charged with manslaughter after allegedly refusing to send a woman an ambulance. Now, obviously, I'll go through the article just before we start. It seems like he didn't so much refuse as be extra awkward about the situation. And you'll see what I mean as it makes sense. Because I always think, like, if you put like refuse, it's just like, I'm not doing it regardless of what you tell me, where it just seems like this guy's being really strange and being tricky about sending out an ambulance. So I'll read it to you. So a 911 operator in Pennsylvania is facing an involuntary manslaughter charge after he allegedly failed to dispatch help to a woman who needed medical assistance. Leon Lee Price, 50, of Waynesburg, was charged in the 2020 death of Diana Kronk, 54. Miss Kronk bled to death a day after her daughter told the dispatcher that without help, she's going to die. Kelly Titchenall, 38, told the Associated Press she believed her mother would still be alive if Mr. Price had sent help. And then it goes into a quote where she literally says that, "I believe she would be alive today if they would have sent an ambulance," she said. In addition to
just, just to interrupt you, I love it when newspapers and stuff do that, when they say somebody said something and then quote them saying exactly that, particularly when it's like two words. It'll be like, "Mr. Smith said that he was fuming." "I'm fuming," said Mr.
Yeah. Well, it's also that she's gone. It's like they've even quoted it wrong before they've said it. So she goes that she said she believed her mother would still be alive if Mr. Price had sent help. What she actually said was, "I believe she would be alive today if they would have sent an ambulance." So, but they just changed it slightly. So it seems like they're the ones who had the great, the thought process.
Yes, yes. That is very weird journalism, isn't it?
So she says, I believe she would be alive today if they would have sent an ambulance. In addition to the manslaughter charge, Mr. Price was also charged with reckless endangerment, official oppression. I don't know what that is. An obstruction. So when Mrs. Titchenall called on the night of her mother's emergency, Mr. Price reportedly questioned her several times over whether or not her mother would agree to be taken for treatment. Then the response was, "She will be, because I'm on the way there. So she's going or she's going to die," Miss Titchenall said on the 911 call. Mr. Price reportedly said that he would send an ambulance, he said, the half hour to pick her up, but insisted that we really need to make sure she's willing to go. Then she says she's going to go, because if not, she's going to die. There's nothing else. Miss Titchenall said her mother wasn't thinking clearly and told Mr. Price that she was her mother's next of kin. Mr. Price was reportedly still not convinced that Miss Kronk would go in the ambulance, so he pressed Miss Titchenall again. She replied by saying, "Okay, well, can we just try?" Approximately 10 minutes before Miss Titchenall reached her mother's house, Mr. Price asked if she would call 911 back to ensure her mother would agree to the ambulance. Upon arrival, they found Miss Kronk naked on the front porch and incoherent. Miss Titchenall dressed her mother in a bathrobe. Her mother repeatedly told her that she was okay, she's fine. "She's the mum, you know, she doesn't listen to her children," Miss Titchenall said. Unfortunately, Miss Titchenall could not find her mother's landline and had no cell service at the home. Miss Titchenall eventually left her mother's house and returned home. She told investigators she did not call 911 again because she felt without her mother present to verbally confirm she would get into an ambulance, the call would be pointless. "This is unheard of to me. I mean, they'll send an ambulance for anything," she said. "And here I am telling this guy that my mum's going to die. It's like her death and she doesn't get an ambulance." Her brother found their mother the next day dead. Mr. Price was arraigned on the 29th of June and was then released on bail. Miss Titchenall's lawyer, Lawrence Boland Jr., said he hopes the case will prevent similar incidents from occurring in the future. "It has to be very clear throughout the entire state that when you call, it's not going to be conditioned on somebody on the other end of the phone saying there's going to be a service provided or not," he said. "What we're trying to do here is make this never happen to somebody else." So the Green County District Attorney is also investigating whether or not any policy or training exists that would allow 911 dispatchers to refuse help to callers. "We all deserve equal protections and we all deserve access to medical services," Dave Russo, the DEA, said in an interview. "I have a major concern as to the safety of the community in regards to this." So, yes, this 911 dispatcher has been charged with manslaughter. Now, it is a strange... It seems pretty straightforward, but it's also slightly weird. I don't understand why he was refusing or needed the person who needs the ambulance to confirm, because most of the time if you need an ambulance, you're not usually in the state to confirm whether you need something or not. So, you know, usually someone turns up. And recently my wife's nan had to have an ambulance come out to the house and she was slightly incoherent. The ambulance came and then it was like the job of the paramedics to try and talk to her and try and get her to speak and get her to come with them in the ambulance and things like that. So it seems like the dispatch is doing the job of the paramedic.
Yes. I mean, I agree with you. It doesn't seem as though that would be the dispatcher's job at all. And it seems as though he's rather overstepped. I mean, you can imagine, can't you, that being a dispatcher, you probably get lots and lots of calls for ambulances and lots of them are plainly unmeritorious, and you'll probably be more than more than the average person aware of the resources that are being used in sending out ambulances. And so I can imagine a degree of sort of frustration, I suppose, at being told, you know, to send ambulances all the time. But this certainly doesn't sound, in the first place, like a case in which that frustration would necessarily boil over, because it sounded as though it was a perfectly meritorious claim for an ambulance. But secondly, and more importantly, as you rightly identify, it's just not the dispatcher's job to decide whether or not ambulances should come out. That is not their role. So the equivalent, I think, in the UK would be gross negligence manslaughter. And for there to be gross negligence manslaughter, there's a couple of interesting wrinkles, because it's gross negligence, you have the same basic principles as all the other types of negligence. So there has to be a duty of care, and that duty has to be breached. So you rightly identified, Dean, this idea of there being a duty of care, meaning that you can't then rely on an omission. That's exactly right. So if we were looking at it from the lens of domestic law, the first question would be whether or not this dispatcher had a duty of care to the mother and to the person who ultimately died. Here's an interesting thing, that the test effectively is whether the person, so the dispatcher, creates or contributes to the creation of a state of affairs which he knows, or reasonably to know, has become life-threatening. And then he has to take reasonable steps to save that person's life. So I think that this dispatcher probably does have a duty of care. Plainly, if he was, you know, a doctor or something like that, and this person sort of came into a hospital and said, you have to help, then doctors tend to have duties of care over their patients. But what do you think? I mean, do you think this is a circumstance in which it would be fair to say the dispatcher actually owes a duty to this?
Yeah, I think he owes a duty, but I think when it comes to the charging of manslaughter, like, I could see that there would definitely be some negative consequence to the way that he reacted on this original call. But my thing, when I'm looking at this story as a whole, of whether he can be charged with manslaughter, is more along the lines of that he was obviously being like difficult about getting it and call me back in 10 minutes. But then at the same time, there has to be something said about the fact that no one ever called them back afterwards. So the mum died. It's not like she got to the house and the mum was dying and she died on the steps. And if he had sent an ambulance at that time, it would have got to her in time and they might have been able to do something about it. Therefore, he was almost directly linked to, within the time frame, failure to get someone out to her. Now, he should have done it anyway. So there will always be something that he is, I believe, guilty of, or an issue, or there'll definitely be a punishment, firing, whatever. But I think when it comes to when you're saying it's manslaughter, is that the daughter then goes, I went home and didn't even try to ring 911 again, didn't even try to get, you know, I just don't know. When I think from a personal thing, if I really think that something's happening to like my mother or something, I would just be constantly all day. Or I would then get someone else to try, or, you know, I'll try and get another dispatcher, because this one's obviously being difficult. So to say that he hasn't got any responsibility in it is a lie. But the fact that it says she went there, she was with her mom, however long she was with her mom, she thought she was going to die. Then I guess she was there for a while. And then she then left to then the son to find her the next day, which means she died throughout the night, which means, like, in time wise, someone could have tried again 911. So it's a bit weird to say, like, this straightforward manslaughter, because to me, I think that's sort of time sensitive. That's, you failed to send something, so, and you failed her because she died within 40 minutes, whereas if you had sent an ambulance, it would have been there within 20 and she could have been saved. Whereas they tried once and then she died, what, 12 hours later?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, to put that through the legal lens, what you're really raising there, I think, is a question of causation, isn't it? As to whether or not this person's conduct, the dispatcher, was bad enough and caused this person to then die, or whether really the causative act was not making more efforts to get the mother an ambulance. So there's kind of two questions there, isn't there? If we assume for a moment that the conduct itself was negligent, did that conduct in any event cause this person to die? And that would be a question really of expert evidence about the prospects of somebody living if the ambulance had been sent when the first call was made. So there's a question there. And then I suppose there's probably a second question. Quite rightly, you identify the fact that the daughter didn't do anything else after a period of time, and whether that failure is actually causative of the death. So I think it would depend, as I say, on expert evidence about what would have happened hypothetically or what the chances would have been of survival if, when the first call was made, the dispatcher sent someone out. But it seems to me that if the evidence is that that person had a, you know, very good chance of survival, there would then be a subsequent question about whether or not the passage of time was the fault of the dispatcher or the fault of the daughter. Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Well, I think it's sort of like it's a bit of an in-between. I think it's both. So, like, obviously, if you sent the ambulance out right there, she would probably still be alive. I don't know what the issue is, actually. It's hard to say that because you don't know what damage had been done already. But obviously, that would be something that's investigated. But, yeah, obviously, if you sent out an ambulance there, then, like you should have, then she'd have had a much better chance. But then also, like I say, it's a long passage of time after. So I agree, he needs to be sacked. He's obviously should have been sent out an ambulance, and I can't see any reason why anyone would refuse, especially when someone on the other end seems so adamant that the person is in peril, based on wanting them to confirm verbally that they want an ambulance, which makes no sense to me, because usually, like you said before, ambulances tend to come out for a lot of people that I'm sure are not able to respond a lot of the time. So that's a bit of a crazy question. So he probably needs to be sacked. Maybe he can be sued, something like that. But I think like a charge of manslaughter based on the amount of time that happened afterwards and the amount of, like you say, how much they tried to, like, to not call back 911 again or even try. He said call back in 10 minutes later, and then she was like, I couldn't get through, so I left it. It's basically what I'm getting from it. And that's not to try and, like, because it also feels crappy that I'm pulling it apart, because obviously it's this person's mother and something like that. And it feels like I'm like victim blaming because this guy should have sent the ambulance. But you'd just do anything, wouldn't you? The brother obviously lives near enough to come and visit. Why don't you quickly drive over to the brothers and make a call, a neighbor? I don't know. It just feels like the first guy that I called was being difficult. And so I just thought, well, I'm not going to try again. And then she died that night.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there are certainly some unanswered questions there, aren't there, in terms of what steps could have been taken? Because nowadays, I mean, you kind of think, worst case scenario, just phone an Uber, you know, bundle them to the hospital.
She obviously drove over as well. So why didn't she drive her mother to the hospital?
Well, exactly. So it does seem strange. But, yeah, we simply don't know.
We don't know. But if it's as clean cut as the article makes out, basing it obviously clearly on that, if it's as clean cut as the article makes out, there seems to be a hell of a lot of options between terrible dispatcher and death.
Yes.
And I feel that saying he is solely responsible for the death is a bit weird, even though he definitely bears some responsibility by not sending out the ambulance when he should have. So like I say, sack him, sue him, do whatever. But I think manslaughter is a bit of a strong one, because that sort of makes you feel like he's directly involved and that, like, time was critical. And obviously there'll be more investigation to find out if that is the case. But given that it wasn't till the next day that she died, there seems to have been quite a bit of time to try and do something in between that call and the death.
Yeah. I agree. I think this will be an interesting one. And just like other cases that we've discussed on the podcast, we will say that we will keep abreast of it and then we'll completely forget and never come back to it.
we'll just ring up the US. I don't know if you listen to our podcast, but we're willing to take the case.
Yes, we should definitely do that.
I thought that was interesting because of the fact that the guy did a terrible job and now he's in a legal dispute looking at manslaughter, and it goes to show the sort of level of pressure that could be on your shoulders in a job, just something like an ambulance dispatcher. Again, I don't understand why he acted the way that he did, but there was definitely a bit of nuance to it. So I thought that was fun to talk about.
Yes, and how right you were.
So, Mike, what is your what happened next for today?
So the what happened next for today is an interesting, very recent case, actually. It's only 6 days old at the time of recording. Decision of the High Court in Bristol in the case of Rushbrook and Four Designs Concept Limited. I should say it's Rushbrook UK Limited rather than a Mr. Rushbrook. Now, as regular seasoned fans of the podcast will know, normally in this section, I read out part of the judgment and ask Dean what happened next. There isn't a sort of pithy part of the judgment that I can really read and then ask what happened next. So I think what I'm going to do is read the opening part and then perhaps give a little bit more information and then simply ask Dean to guess what happened next. So this is the first paragraph of the judgment of His Honour Judge Paul Matthews. And it says, on the 9th of May, 2022, I heard the claimant company's application for an injunction to restrain presentation of a winding up petition. On the 13th of May, I handed down judgments in this matter, giving my reasons for striking out the application. This was on the basis that one of the only two directors of the company, Mr. Steventon Smith, had no authority on his own to make or give instructions to make the application on the company's behalf. He then says, the judge received some written submissions as to further things and made an assessment of costs. Then he goes on to say, a further primary submission from the respondent was that the applicant's solicitors, Neath Raisbeck Golding Law, should show cause why they should not be ordered to be jointly liable with the company for the wasted costs of the application. So it's not so much of what happened next, but more of a kind of, why do you think that that was an issue in this case? And indeed, what happened next? Do you think the solicitors were responsible for the costs of that application?
So it's one of the directors. I thought it was two companies after each other.
So there are two companies in the case.
Yeah.
One of them tried to wind up the other, which is the company equivalent of bankruptcy. So okay. One of them was owed a debt and tried to get them wound up. The company that was threatened with winding up issued at court an injunction to stop the winding up petition from being presented to the courts. So that was the sort of fundamental application. It was an application for an injunction by the debtor company.
Okay. But it was only one of them that did it. So only one of the directors tried to do it, and he's not allowed to do it on his own. It needs to be two of them.
Yeah. Company had two directors, and the one director effectively was the active one. Yeah.
So why would the solicitors be an issue? Is it not his fault?
Well, that's the question.
I think it's his fault then, isn't it? So I say it's his fault. And then what happened next is the company that is in debt is no longer in debt, and now they're a flourishing company.
I don't know so much about that part, but but interestingly, the wasted costs order was against both the company and that one director, Mr. Steventon Smith. And then following on from this case, the one from which I've already read, the judge found that the solicitor's firm should also be jointly liable for the costs. The argument that the judge accepted was that because the company couldn't act on the basis of one director alone, that when the solicitors issued the application for an injunction, they actually didn't have any instructions to do it.
Oh, so they should have known better.
Exactly. They should have known better. And they shouldn't have proceeded without instructions. So I thought that was quite interesting, because you can imagine a solicitor thinking that they have instructions from one director of a company and that being sufficient. But it turned out in this case that it was not sufficient.
So why was the other director, why did the other director not back it up then?
I think the two directors had fallen out, and so one was just not basically involved at all. So he didn't sort of care what happened, really.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. And that he's still a director of the company.
Well, I don't know if he still is, to be fair. We'll never know. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. And also, one of the arguments that the solicitor raised in the case was that the law in relation to this was slightly unclear. And the judge found that there was no evidence that the solicitor had actually checked the law at the time. And he also said, frankly, the law is not that unclear. So any competent, reasonable solicitor should have known.
All right. So how do you find evidence that a solicitor checks the law? I mean, that's like saying, I haven't got evidence that Dean is on chapter 31 of A Game of Thrones.
Well, that's right. So the solicitor put in a witness statement in relation to the application, and he didn't include in that witness statement any suggestion, really, that he had actually checked.
Oh, so he didn't like reference anything that was reading.
Yeah. I mean, of course, one of the things that you could do nowadays, if you particularly wanted to, is if you do a lot of your research online now, as we tend to do, rather than using it through the physical books, you can, I think, save a record of what you've been looking at so that you can then basically pick up where you left off. So if there was a situation like that, then you could exhibit to your statement that sort of record of what you've been looking at, and at least prove that, you know, at the relevant time you'd been considering the authorities or something like that. That would have been really useful, I think.
So why does a company try and bankrupt another company? Just purely that he owed enough money that it would bankrupt that company, and not because that they any maliciously just wanted to shut that company down?
No, that's right. I mean, winding up petitions are pretty common because, in a sense, they're a sort of nuclear option for the party that's owed the money, because what you don't really want to do is to have the company that owes you money wound up, because if they are, then you certainly won't recover everything that you're owed. And it's quite possible you'll recover, you know, a couple of pence in the pound at best. But a wound up company obviously is defunct. So it's quite a useful tool to start winding up proceedings, because that tends to mean that your debt becomes the biggest priority for the company to pay off, so as to stop the winding up process. So it's a bit of a tactical tool most of the time.
Okay, so they put the injunction in, and usually that would stop it from winding them up. But then at the same time, they know that, like, your top priority to start paying off their debt.
Exactly, yeah, because you kind of think, well, if we've got, you know, total debts of £100,000 and we owe 40 grand to this company, and we've got £50,000 that we can use to pay off our debts, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So the one that's trying to wind us up will be the one that will get paid off, so that we don't end up being wound up.
So basically, it's like legal threat.
Yes, exactly. And it's exactly the same in personal insolvency as well, in bankruptcy. Quite often, a creditor will serve a statutory demand on someone and say, if you don't do something about this demand for money in the next 3 weeks, then we'll present a bankruptcy petition. And it's not because they necessarily want to make that person bankrupt, but it just tends to focus the mind of the recipients of the statutory demand that if they're going to pay any debts, they should probably pay off this one. Yeah.
Well, I feel like I've learned something there. So, and also the two directors of the company need to get along and talk to each other, and they wouldn't be in this issue. So what would actually happen to them now? Just like the cost of whatever that legal proceeding is will be charged towards them. So nothing's happened yet. So the actual winding up thing can't happen until that other director gets involved also.
Well, the winding up can carry on. So the application for the injunction to stop the winding up was struck out. So I don't know whether that therefore will, the winding up will now proceed. That'll be up to the creditor company, I suppose. Okay. But whether or not the director of the debtor company is involved doesn't prevent somebody from winding that company up.
Okay, so just make sure if you have multiple directors of your company that you all talk to each other and get along and make up your decisions before you start any legal proceedings or other things of that nature. Like, I need to make sure with Mike all the time before I create our marketing stuff and put our faces on cans of Iron Brew and such, because it wouldn't be fair to stick both of our faces on if Mike was unhappy with Iron Brew for any reason.
No, exactly. And we had that big falling out about the holding court speedboat, didn't we? As to whether it should have my face at the front or your face or both.
Yes.
And in the end, we went for two speedboats, which I think was sensible.
Well, I said to him, I said, I didn't mind if he had his face on the front of the speedboat, but I was definitely putting my face at the side of the super yacht. So,
yes, exactly. In short, it's all about compromise, isn't it?
Yes. And that's how it works, people. So there you go.
Yes, don't forget to donate to our Patreon.
So now we move on to the segment of the show we call I Call Bullshit. And this is a segment of the show where I present Mike with a crime, a law, a case, usually in article format or meme format that's been shared around the internet. And I ask Mike if it's true or false. This is our way of debunking those sort of like fake stories that get sent around, like a man was found with 7,000 dragon eggs in his house and sued for 3 million. And everyone's like, oh my God. And then we're like, well, actually, that's not true because dragons don't exist.
Wait, what?
So, well, it could be Komodo dragons. Maybe they just put in an article headline that drives more people their way. So
I would love to go to the Galapagos Islands because I think they have lots of dragons there. I don't know, Komodo dragons and other things. I should probably check that before I go,
but
just in case I'm wrong.
They're like incredibly dangerous though, aren't they?
Are they?
Yeah, so basically, if I am correct here, I think in their saliva or something, in they have a bacteria in their mouth that if they bite you, you're dead. It's like highly, highly toxic.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That's throwing my summer holiday plans into disarray.
I think that's correct. You can fact check at home. I always say to fact check anything I say. And that's the point of I Call Bullshit, is to fact check articles and things that get sent around. So,
I think bacteria does not get enough credit because it's really dangerous.
I thought you were going into more of a spiel then.
No, I mean, that's kind of it, really. Like, bacteria is really dangerous and people never sort of think about it. And I think it's a shame. And I feel a bit bad for the bacteria.
Yes.
Because if they were big, then people would be like, Jesus Christ. But because they're so tiny, they just kind of get overlooked as a powerful source.
So it says, so what makes a Komodo dragon's bite lethal? Komodo dragons possess a potent venom delivered through their razor sharp teeth. This venom can kill humans within a few hours. Ah, so it is a venom. I thought it was a bacteria. But still, bacteria is bad. Clean your wounds, yes. People.
Yes, venom is also bad.
Yes, I was close. You can still die. Komodo dragons are dangerous. Stay away from them. Don't have them as pets.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally you were right, weren't you? I mean, if I was dying, you know, from a Komodo dragon bite, and I said, the bacteria have got me, and somebody went, kind of, well, actually, it's a venom, I don't think that would be terribly comforting to me. So I think fundamentally you were right there, Dean.
Yeah, and if they're dressed in lovely silks, still stay away from them. That's just a kimono dragon. Yes, the podcast. Stand-up show is coming to an arena near you soon.
Yes, right. So let's move on because this segment is starting to drag on.
Hey! All right. So this is more of like a crime stat, and I want you to tell me if it's true or false, if it is bullshit or not. Is the lowest crime in the US on Mother's Day?
That's interesting. I can certainly... No, I don't reckon it is, because I think... Because I know that there's a lot of crime on Christmas Day and around that time, because families get together and that causes crime. So I presume it'll be a sort of smaller version of that on like Mother's Day and Father's Day. So I think there would be an above average amount of crime on those kind of events rather than the lowest amount of crime. So I think that is bullshit.
It is bullshit. Yes. So it was a lot of meme stuff going around saying that Mother's Day was the lowest crime because everybody was out with their mums and not committing crimes. But but basically, no, it is false. In the US, Mother Day sees less crime than any other day is false. So the fact check, as Mother's Day approached in May 2022, a popular joke recirculated on social media that provided a humorous explanation as to why this annual holiday supposedly had historically low crime rates. Mother's Day saw so little crime, the joke offered, because the holiday prevented mums from going on their regular crime sprees. So it says underneath, so it's like a meme of a guy that looks like a football player. And he's like, my mum is a prosecutor. And every year she brings up the fact that Mother's Day is the day with the lowest crime. I think that says a lot about how many mums commit crimes throughout the year, but can't today because they're too busy being celebrated. But then I've also seen where people say that everybody is with their mums and that is why they do not commit crimes on Mother's Day. Pretty sure it's Hallmark that probably came up with this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they come up with a lot of weird stuff to try and justify their existence, so I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Do you think there is a day of the year where crime is probably less? I mean, it's obviously not Christmas Day. Is it the day after Christmas when they're on Boxing Day when everyone's just tired from all the crime they've been committing on Christmas Day?
Yeah, crime around Christmas time is a bit like, you know, having another quality streak. Come Boxing Day, you're just like, oh, I couldn't possibly commit any more crime. I'd love to, but I just can't do it.
Yeah.
I would have thought that no day with an event on it would be the lowest day that there would be crime. I think it would have to be a day when there's sort of nothing happening, because the more that people feel stressed by events, and the more that people particularly are compelled to spend time with people they wouldn't normally spend time with, then the increased likelihood there is a crime happening. So by crime, I should say, I don't mean sort of, you know, conspiratorial, everyone getting together and then going out to rob somewhere, but, you know, people having a punch up, all that sort of stuff. So I think it would actually be a completely innocuous day that's not connected to any kind of event or celebration.
So it'd be like some day probably in like February, where like you've got over the sort of Christmas blues and being skint, you've been maybe paid once since Christmas, but it's dark and horrible and you're not really going out much. There isn't really a big event. Maybe it's prior to Valentine's Day, maybe. And it's just a day where everyone's sat in because no one wants to go out in the cold.
Well, I wonder actually if it would be slightly later in the year than that, just because when people are all stuck in together, again, that's when crime happens.
We can't go out together because too much crime. We can't stay in together because of too much crime.
So I reckon it'd be early springtime, because that's when it's not so hot that people are out drinking all day, and it's light enough that people are kind of out and able to do things and they're not feeling the winter gloom. So I reckon sometime in maybe March or April. Okay. It'd be fascinating to know, actually, wouldn't it?
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, from the stats that we've just made up on the spot, if you want to have a less of a chance of being involved in a crime, not personally, or I mean, maybe the victim of, maybe you do want to cause, no, but then if you're doing it, then you're causing more crime. Anyway, there isn't much crime in March, supposedly, so just go out there, just go out there and have a good time.
That is excellent advice.
Yes, I think the Department of Statistics holding court tower has definitely done a good job there.
Absolutely.
So let me see if it says anything here. So while the joke's language did not make clear where or under what law enforcement jurisdiction crime rates supposedly reached low points on Mother's Day, the purpose of this fact check, we attempted to prove or disprove the claim for the US specifically. That said, the claim that Mother's Day in the US has less crime than any other day of the year does not appear to be supported by any evidence. We weren't able to find any studies that supported this claim. The FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program generates national crime statistics that law enforcement agencies use worldwide. We might look into that. But these data were not organized in a way to show the number of crimes on any specific date. We reached out to the FBI, and the spokesperson told us that the UCR program collects data on a monthly basis. So with relevant national crime statistics unavailable, we set out to find data from local jurisdictions that could give us an idea of this claim. If this claim had any water in Chicago, a spokesperson for the CPD told us, we don't have a way to break down crime stats by date year in this office. However, we found police databases in two major cities, Minneapolis and New York City, that provided crime statistics on a date-by-date basis. We did a rudimentary search through New York City Police Department's database to compare the number of arrests for crimes that range from burglary to assault to criminal mischief to rape to traffic misdemeanors. That's quite the broad search on Mother's Day compared to other Sundays throughout the year, and found that there didn't appear to be anything particularly unusual about the number of arrests on Mother's Day. On Mother's Day on May the 10th, 2020, for example, NYPD documented 265 arrests. While that was less than the number of arrests the following Sunday, the agency tallied 353. We found several dates that saw less crime. For example, in that year, April 12th saw 196 arrests, April 5th saw 170 arrests, and March 29th saw 152 arrests. You did it. You cracked it.
Hey, there we go. Look at that.
Early April and late March seem to have been the times with the least arrests.
Boom. The power of logic.
But supposedly in Minneapolis, it also showed the number of crimes didn't suspiciously drop on Mother's Day. Oh. So there we go. So be careful where you take your mum on Mother's Day. She could be involved in a crime.
Yeah, just be on the safe side and take her down the police station.
Yeah. But that was nice to see that we managed to find out when the least amount of crime happened by just guessing. and then being backed up by the NYPD facts. And I would assume that, that's a pretty good reference to go off. I mean, I know it's a pretty different kind of environment to like where we live. But, you know, as far as I'm aware, New York is quite a crime hotspot. Sorry for any New Yorkers that are listening. But like big metropolis cities like that, they tend to... Well, is it? Is it metropolis? Am I correct?
Yeah, I think so. Metropolis. Yeah. I think... Do we call it a conurbation? What's the difference between a conurbation and a metropolis?
The difference is I only heard about the word conurbation when you just said it now.
Well, there we are then.
It's a conurbation and maybe a metropolis. We don't know. But, you know, big cities tend to have big crime. So, therefore, if we can get stats of a place like that, I would assume that it works pretty much across the board.
Yeah, I would think so. I think the human nature is the same, whether you're in New York or, you know, Coventry.
Then again, we completely guessed the last stat. So, you know, I think we're right.
Yeah, I think we are.
Okay, so I will leave it there today with the good news that everybody's got March, end of March and April to look forward to next year for a rest from the crime.
Only if they make it through to next March.
Yeah, if you make it through to next March, then you've got the high crime of Christmas to come yet. So do you have anything to say before we leave, Mike?
I do. As you'll know, dear listener, you rely on me and Dean to tell you what national day it is today. Today's a weird one. It's July the 10th, and it's National Clerihue Day. Now, Clerihue is somebody I had never heard of before, but he was a chap called Edmund Clerihue Bentley, which is a name to conjure with. Have you ever heard of this guy, Dean?
Well, he's not the guy who created the Bentley, is he?
I don't think so. That's not what his national day is about. He created, you know, like a haiku. Created like a different type of poetry. So his poetry, I should say, Mr. Bentley lived between 1875 and 1956. So it was a simpler time. But he created a poetry.
Yeah, there were only
set.
Two world wars between that.
Well, exactly. Things were pretty much fine. So he created a type of poetry called a clerihue, and it has four lines, contains rhyming couplets AABB. You have to include a person's name in the first line. You have to say something about that person, and you have to be humorous. So, I mean, the humor, you know, doesn't really travel through time quite as well as it might. But so one example of a clerihue poem written by Edmund Clerihue Bentley is this. Sir Christopher Wren said, I'm going to dine with some men. If anyone calls, say I'm designing St. Paul's. And that is an example of a clerihue. And so on the 10th of July, it's National Clerihue Day. So why not, dear listener, write yourself a clerihue about somebody close to you or somebody who is not close to you.
Except for when they hear this podcast, it won't be National Clerihue Day.
Well, dear listener, if you have neglected to observe National Clerihue Day, take this as your stern reminder that you are one poem in deficit and it's time to make it up before the next National Clerihue Day, because it will be upon us again before you know it. And I think, if anything, National Clerihue Day is becoming too commercialised, but that's a different discussion.
If anything, write a clerihue about the Holding Court podcast and send it in to us.
Oh, that's an excellent idea.
And we'll read it on the podcast.
Yes, and if you can fit both of us in the one poem, we can call it a clerihue.
Ooh, there you go. And then we'll invent that, and we'll have our own national day.
Yes, we'll steal your idea.
No, you just gave them the idea.
That is true. That is true. That is clerihue.
They will just do the hard manual work.
Yes,
of writing a clerihue.
Exactly. Exactly. So do that, dear listener, and we will be forever grateful whilst we sip champagne on our yachts and speedboats.
Okay, so we'll leave that there for this week. We thank you for tuning in again, and we hope you tune in again next week for another exciting episode of Holding Court.
Goodbye, everybody.
If you know of any strange court or legal cases you would like us to discuss on the show, feel free to email us at holding.court@outlook.com.